Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our, I should say, welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. Well, we were scheduled to talk in this hour of Focus 580 with Tamim Ansari. We would be talking about his book, Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, and we weren't quite able to hook up with him, so we'll see if we can get the problem there straightened out, and we'll have him with us on another day. In the meantime, what we've done is gone into our Focus archive to repeat a program that we first broadcast, I believe, in late April. So as you listen to this hour, Focus 580, do keep in mind that just for this hour, we'll not be taking calls. This morning, in the first hour, we'll talk about the rise of the social networking website MySpace. It is one of the most visited internet destinations in America. And even by the standards of the internet age, the growth of MySpace is an astounding story, one which climaxed with the purchase of the site by Rupert Murdoch's online empire for a sum getting close to $1 billion. We'll get the story this morning of what might well be the defining drama of the digital era as we talk with Julia Angwin. She's author of the book Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. Random House is the publisher. She is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She writes about the convergence of technology and media for the newspaper. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. She grew up actually in Silicon Valley. Her parents both worked in technology. She went to college at University of Chicago, majoring in math. She worked summers at Hewlett-Packard and was thinking that probably she would get into the technology industry after college, but she made the mistake of going down to get a job at the college newspaper there and really fell in love with journalism. And after that, she worked as an intern at the Washington Post. She worked for the San Francisco Chronicle and then went on to write for the Wall Street Journal. And we're pleased to have her joining us this morning. Julia Angwin, hello.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Well, thanks. It's a very interesting subject. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening to us this morning are familiar with social networking services like MySpace or Facebook or Twitter, and that they use those things. But I think also probably there are some people who don't. Maybe they've heard of these things, but they aren't really quite sure what they are. So that might be a good place for us to start. For those not into the world of social networking, what is MySpace or Facebook? What are they for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can just pause in 1 second and say that I loved your bio of me, and you know, I was born in Champaign. Can you believe that?
You're kidding me.
I'm actually, my parents were teaching at the university, and we moved to California when I was 4. But I did spend my first 4 years there. So this is home in a small way for me. So that's exciting. So I appreciate that. And yeah, but your question about what these networks are is a good one, right? It's not entirely clear at the outset why you should join one or what is the purpose of being on these sites. Mm-hmm. And really, in some sense, it's about making connections with people from your past, from your future. It's for a lot of professionals who are my age, it's about networking, you know, building your contacts for the next job. It's about the same as sending out Christmas cards, except it's a lot easier. Mm.
The big, probably the two big rivals in this kind of business at the moment are MySpace and Facebook. MySpace, and correct me if I'm wrong here, globally, I guess Facebook is the biggest, but MySpace in the United States has more users?
It does, although Facebook is gaining on them, and MySpace in the U.S. and MySpace has been stagnant in the U.S., so it's likely Facebook will overtake them fairly soon.
And how many people are there for, how many users are there for these things?
I think worldwide, Facebook has somewhere around 230 million. Don't hold me to these exactly. Mm-hmm. And MySpace is sort of around 130 million.
Okay.
But that's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. One of the things that's really interesting here when you look at how it is that MySpace developed, and I'm sure that we'll also be saying some things, you'll be saying some things about Facebook. The two of these have very different personalities, and that I'm sure in some sense is a reflection of the people who created them. So then maybe the thing to do would be to talk a little bit particularly about these two guys who really created MySpace, and those are Chris DeWolf and Tom Anderson. Tell us something about them.
Yeah, so Chris and Tom Tom were LA guys. They lived in Los Angeles. They were working. Tom was a struggling musician, and Chris hired him at a dot-com startup during the boom in 2000. And they met. They got along really well. They were kind of marketers first and foremost. They basically saw things that were popular online and would imitate them. They were fast moving. For instance, when the U.S. invaded Iraq, within a few weeks, they had put out some copies of those trading cards with pictures of all the Iraqi bad guys. I guess they were the administration officials that we were trying to catch. I don't know if everyone remembers. There were all these names out there. We had to catch all these guys. And so they quickly printed up a bunch of these cards and were selling them on the internet. So they were kind of opportunists. They would jump in at a moment and hawk something.
Yeah. So they were people who the kinds of things that they did would not make them widely admired. They were involved in spam. They were involved in spyware. It seemed that they were kind of they certainly weren't techies. They were cyberspace fringe dwellers.
Yes. I say they lived on the fringes of the internet economy, and that's what makes their story so interesting, because you don't often see guys coming in from the fringe and working their way into the middle. The typical story on the internet, you know, you got a guy from Stanford, he starts his business in his dorm room, he's super smart, gets a bunch of venture capital backing. And that's not the story here. That's why I thought it was so fascinating, because I think it sort of says something about where we are with technology, that now it's easy enough to use, that it's not just the super smart computer scientists who are running these companies, but actually marketers can run an internet business as well.
Yeah. The title of the book, I think, works on a number of levels, and maybe the first level has to do with the fact that the guys that we're talking about, Chris DeWolf and Tom Anderson, they didn't, for them, MySpace was not an original idea. They actually saw somebody who was doing it, somebody else who was doing it, and they said, that looks pretty good. Let's do that.
Exactly. Yeah. There was a website called Friendster. It was really popular. It was the hot site of its time, and this was in 2003. And MySpace, their spam business, their spyware business was actually drying up at that time, and they were looking for something new to do. So they thought, okay, we'll copy Friendster. So they made pretty much an exact replica, but they had two key things that made them different, and those were really the key to their success. One is they let people be whoever they wanted to be. So you could pretend to be someone else on MySpace. Friendster, like Facebook now, wants you to use your real name. Secondly, they let people customize their pages and decorate them with wallpaper and glitter and all this stuff. If you've been to MySpace, it looks like a blinking, flashing, music-playing kind of crazy quilt.
Mm. And that's what's interesting here. I guess, as I said, that's sort of one level that the stealing style works on, because they really appropriated the idea of MySpace from Friendster. Although, to be fair, I think you also have to say, well, the Friendster people, they didn't invent the idea either. They actually stole it, if you want to use that term. They borrowed it. They appropriated it. They took it from somebody else. So they didn't invent the idea either.
Agreed. I mean, this is an idea that has been around as long as the internet. People have been desperate to interact with each other, to set up pages representing themselves online and to interact. So social networking has been around forever. But each one of these sites adds their own flavor or layer to it that is unique.
Yeah. Our guest, just very quickly, let me reintroduce Julia Angwin. She is an award-winning journalist. She works for the Wall Street Journal, where she writes about the convergence of technology and media. And she is the author of a recently published book, Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. Random House is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, you mentioned the fact that there were really two things about MySpace that helped to contribute to its success. And one is, it is unlike Facebook, where you must be yourself. You must, if you're on there, you have to be you. On MySpace, you don't. And that apparently was one of the things that really, and I think actually it was Tom Anderson, who looked at Friendster, said, okay, this is a good idea. We can do this. But he also said, you know, though, I think that they've missed the boat here by telling people, no, you go on there, you've got to be honest, you've got to say, this is me, this is who I am. He said, you know, why not let people use a pseudonym? Why not let them, if they want to go on and say that they're Britney Spears, he would say, okay, go ahead and do that. Was there something there about that? Did he really have this definite sort of idea that said, They really missed a great opportunity here to attract business by letting people use whatever name they wanted.
Yes, he did. He was really smart to identify that opportunity. And it led to, you know, one of the things is there's this woman, Tila Tequila, who he recruited early on to leave Friendster and come to MySpace. Tila Tequila's last name is not Tequila, it's Nguyen. But she's made a career for herself as she started on MySpace putting pictures of herself in bikinis. Now she has that MTV show. She is in the tabloids a lot. She's made a name for herself through MySpace. But she was getting kicked off of Friendster because she wasn't using her real name and she was putting up pictures that were too sexy. So MySpace, and Tom realized, look, people like her have a huge audience, have 40,000 friends. I'm going to recruit her to come over to MySpace. And he did, and that was a huge start for MySpace.
Yeah, she's one of these people that we have today that's kind of famous for being famous.
Yeah.
And he really thought, now this is, if we can get people like that, people who will create a lot of buzz by their
right.
presence and then will get people to go to your site, that is a good thing, and you can build a lot of excitement and a higher profile by getting people like that. And he also really was interested in getting musicians on. And I think still musicians are big users of the site because they can use it to promote themselves and their music.
Right. I mean, I call this their nightclub strategy. Mm-hmm. Basically, they had the musician strategy and they had the model strategy, right? So the combination of good-looking women and men in rock bands and a vibe that felt kind of nightclubby. And they had parties. For the first year, every month they would go to a different city. Tom would have a party with a local band at a local club, and all the MySpace members would meet each other. So it was a deliberate attempt to make this feel like a nightclub.
The other thing that you mentioned, and interestingly enough, while this really worked well for them, that is, people can essentially do whatever they want with their pages. They can customize their pages, unlike Facebook, where it's like a form. You fit into that mold. You can't mess around with it. That actually, this thing that made MySpace stand out, it was an accident. It was not something that they started out intending to do.
Yes, you're right. It was very funny. So in the early days, they had built MySpace really quickly with a couple of programmers, and they forgot to block people from entering HTML, which is the web programming language, into their profiles. So at first, they didn't quite realize what was going on when they would look at profiles and see that they had backgrounds, and then they realized they had forgotten to stop people from doing this. They quickly realized that this was not a bug, it was a feature, something that a lot of companies have tried to convert bugs into features in the past. And it turned out that people really loved customization. It was what drew a lot of their audience. Hmm.
Well, was there a point, at least early on, when they realized there was that bug, did they run around saying, oh my God, this is terrible, we have to fix this, before
yes,
they realized that it was a good thing?
Yeah, they originally were going to block it. They thought, oh my gosh, we got to fix this. Because it was a problem, and it still remains a problem, that it's much harder to load a page with all this stuff on it. So sometimes a MySpace page can be pretty slow to load when you visit it. Mm-hmm. And so they've always struggled with the fact that this is a drain on their computer systems. But because they were marketers and not technologists first and foremost, they realized the value of letting people do what they wanted to do. And they made that trade-off, and it has worked out well for them.
Yeah. The two founders, Chris DeWolf and Tom Anderson, they did not talk with you. You did not work with them. So I think we would have to say this is something of an unauthorized biography. So you couldn't sit down and do a one-on-one with them. But, you know, having said that, and I'm sure that they have talked about what they've done, and you managed to talk to a lot of people who were connected with this to work on the book. So do they make any claim to being visionary promoters of self-expression? Or if they were being honest, would they say, you know, really, we just stumbled onto a great way to make a lot of money?
Well, first of all, let me just say, I call my book unauthorized but well-documented. That's how I describe it. But they have always said, and I think this is actually a very good description, that they wanted to be the MTV of the Internet. And they have sort of succeeded in that. It's an interactive place that focuses on music and really attracts a similar kind of audience. So they actually philosophically had themselves pointed in one direction pretty early on. However, that being said, they had a lot of lucky breaks along the way.
And I guess one thing it does sort of strike me as, at least you would say about these two guys, is that always they seem to have been a little bit more sympathetic to the users than to the suits.
Yes, they have been, particularly Tom, who has a real strong profile on the site. He's the first friend of everybody who joins, and people come to him with their problems, and he often tries to address, he can't at this point handle every customer complaint, but he really tries to create a feeling that he is there for the user, and people send him little notes on his page. He often replies, and so he creates a vibe around him. There was a rumor of his death a while back, and so all these people posted, like, without you, Tom, I would just not, you know, I would have to leave MySpace. So there's a real feeling about him. By the way, you know, he and Chris both announced last week they're stepping down. So it will be interesting to see what happens. Hopefully he'll stay as everyone's first friend.
Aren't they? Well, I guess that this is an open question about whether they that DeWolf, he's going to leave his job of as the CEO, and Anderson, he will probably move into some kind of different jobs. Is there some sort of question about whether they'll continue in any capacity to be involved with the company, or whether they might actually just leave completely?
I think that Chris has said he's going to leave completely, and Tom is going to stay and do something different at MySpace. So that's what they've announced so far, and I would imagine that Tom will continue to have this role with customers because that's so important. He's really the soul of the site.
We talked a little bit earlier. You talked about one of the things that really contributed greatly to the success of MySpace was this thing that people can go on there and they can say who they are, but then again, they can put whatever name on there that they want. And I think that there are some people that worry that this has kind of a dark side to it and that there's potential for people doing harm. And in fact, I think probably people will remember this story of a girl who was, at least her parents felt, that she was driven to suicide as a result of cyberbullying that was carried out by, was sort of orchestrated by the mother of a classmate. I think some kids were involved in this too. And MySpace was the vehicle that they used to do this. How do people particularly do have some sense of how DeWolf and Anderson actually feel about the fact that their site could be used that way?
I know it's such a hard and terrible thing what happened to that girl, and it happens all the time on a much smaller scale, cyberbullying. It's one of the biggest problems with a site that allows people anonymity is that you don't know who to trust and you don't know who you're dealing with, right? Which there is some element of security around Facebook because you think you know who you're talking to. That said, if Facebook is not actually verifying people's identities in any way that is equivalent to like showing a driver's license. So they are also relying in some sense on people's faith. But MySpace feels much scarier because people can much more easily pretend to be someone else. And that's a really hard thing to figure out how to run a site like that safely, because once you can either try to verify identities, which is difficult to do. We don't have a good system for that right now. It's like you can't just call up Social Security Administration and say, okay, I want to run all these Social Security numbers through you and check everyone's identity. So it's really, unfortunately, the onus is on the parents right now because they have to be involved with what their kids are doing. What I say all the time about MySpace is you wouldn't drop your kids off at a playground where you didn't know any of the other kids. And this is what MySpace is. It's a playground where you don't know who all these other people are. So parents have to get involved and protect their kids from these kind of events.
Yeah. And this, I talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the two big rivals, Facebook, MySpace, do have these rather different personalities, and that has something to do with the structure. And this particular issue is a big feature, and I think that probably it may, people, maybe their faith is misplaced, but I think they have this idea that Facebook is a safer space. It's not quite as dangerous, and that MySpace does have this slightly darker, edgier quality to it. And those two things, I'm sure that probably for both of them, those two things work to their advantage in the sense that, you know, it depends on how maybe you think of yourself, that you might think of yourself as either a MySpace person or a Facebook person, and, you know, for one or the other reason, gravitate to one of the other places.
Yeah, that's true. I think that in general, Facebook feels a little safer because we're using real names. But like I said, they're not verifying identities. So in some sense, there's a false sense of security on that site. People put up a lot more personal information because they feel like they're in this warm bubble, but there have been many times that people have used that information against each other. So one story is, you know, a woman who changed her status to single and then her husband murdered her because of that. So by presenting your information in what you think is a safe space, you might not have done that. And you might have been better off doing that on an anonymous website, right? Yeah. And I think there's space for both kinds of experiences. There are places online we want to be anonymous, and there are places we want to be who we are. And I think that neither one of these sites has really fully cracked that nut, because MySpace, the anonymity is just too scary there. There's not enough controls. But where on Facebook, I believe that the real name value of it is not actually supported by true verification. So both are sort of, that one is like falsely appears safe. So I think that we as a society are still struggling with how to represent our identities online in a way that's authenticated.
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's interesting, because that's perhaps one of the answers to the question, well, why do we need these things, or why do we need so many of them? And the answer might be, well, because things like MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, they serve different functions. They do different things, and it's one could certainly, I mean, there would be nothing to prevent someone from being on both Facebook and MySpace, both, and on the one be themselves, and on the other be somebody else, or be whoever they wanted to be, and that they could do both of those things because they do different things.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, probably the world is going to end up in the same world I'm at, which is I have every one of these things, and I spent too much of my life updating them all. I will say one thing about Twitter, which is I think they have threaded this needle nicely, because both MySpace and Facebook are built on this idea of friendship, which is a two-way relationship. One person requests friendship from another person, and that person approves them. Then both people can send each other updates. Twitter is a one-way relationship where you just sign up. I want to get your updates because I'm interested in your show, but you don't have to follow me because you have no idea who I am. I'm just one of your listeners. So by making the relationship one-way, it actually removes some of the fiction of friendship, where people are friends with people they don't actually know, which I think leads to this kind of interaction that can be more scary, where if you automatically just know this is a one-way thing, I just want this person's updates, it's much more utilitarian, it doesn't have the fiction of friendship. So I think that's an interesting model that we'll be seeing more of in the future, not just on Twitter.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Julia Angwin. She works for the Wall Street Journal. She writes about the convergence of technology and media. She's the author of the recent book Stealing MySpace, The Battle for Control, the Most Popular Website in America. It's published by Random House. As she said at the beginning of the program, she was born in Champaign and did some of her growing up here and also in California in Silicon Valley. And when she went to college, she was thinking, well, maybe she'd go into the technology industry. In fact, she went to University of Chicago and majored in math. She worked summers at Hewlett-Packard but got bit by the journalism bug, wrote for the paper there at the college, then after that worked for the San Francisco Chronicle, and also worked for the Wall Street Journal, and still works for the Wall Street Journal. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And just to raise this question of your connection with the Journal and the owner of the Journal's connection with MySpace, that seems to be something that people are curious about, and I'm sure you're asked often that somehow people think that because ultimately you work for Rupert Murdoch, because he now owns the Journal, and that he also owns MySpace, that somehow his company, News Corp, might somehow not be happy about the fact that you had written this book, and it sounds like they really don't care.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for them, but they have been very tolerant of the fact that I wrote this unauthorized book about, you know, as you said, somewhat of the shady past of the MySpace founders, things they may not have wanted out there. That said, you know, when I left to write this book, the Journal was not owned by Rupert Murdoch, so this is somewhat of a legacy situation. But so far, I have to say, I've been very pleased that Rupert Murdoch, I think, has a very tough skin. He's been beaten up by a lot of newspapers over the years, so everything seems to be fine so far.
Well, let's talk a bit, move on to this next phase in the story where Rupert Murdoch indeed comes into the picture. And he gets interested because he's interested in the potential of the internet, and goes on a shopping spree. And they, they started thinking about what it is they might like to acquire. And apparently, MySpace initially was not on the list, and it was something that, though, caught his interest anyway. How was it that Rupert Murdoch even came to know that MySpace existed and then started to think about wanting to buy it?
Well, so this is the perfect example of, like, how Rupert Murdoch operates, right? He hires McKinsey to come up with a whole plan on how he should get into the internet, and they do this huge plan, and there's a huge list of companies to buy, and he doesn't do anything on it. He just operates... He operates on a much more opportunistic level, which is he knows he wants to get into the internet. He reads this whole report. But then when something interesting comes available, it's a matter of, oh, that's available, MySpace. I'm going to look into it. That looks really interesting. And he moved really fast because MySpace, it was a complicated sale, which we talked about the title Stealing MySpace also refers to the sale, mm-hmm. that they had to be bought quickly for reasons that we can go into if you want.
Well, this was indeed, as we said, the title works on a number of levels. At one level is that the guys who started it, DeWolf and Anderson, really took the idea from somebody else. Friendster already existed. They said, well, this looks pretty good. Let's do that. But another level has to do with the way the deal for MySpace went down. I guess what happened here, we had two media titans who were interested in it and in some competition. One is Rupert Murdoch. The other is Sumner Redstone, Mr. Viacom. And they both were following different paths. Apparently, Murdoch, what his strategy was to negotiate with the parent company that owned MySpace. And Redstone, he was trying to negotiate with MySpace. So they're both of them were working on different levels. And I suppose one question would be, well, how could that both of those things be possible? How could you try to work this two different ways?
Well, it was a strange situation. It basically came down to the fact that MySpace had a really strange relationship with its parent company, where basically they had a relationship where if MySpace became a certain popular enough that it was worth more than $125 million, MySpace had the right to sell itself and stop the parent company from having a sale. And so because of that, the parent company knew it had to sell itself secretly without MySpace knowing if it wanted the value for MySpace, because MySpace had basically veto power if it got a deal first. So they were both trying to get deals quickly. Sumner Redstone made a mistake. He had some bankers, and he fought with them in the middle of the deal about their fee. So then he had to switch bankers mid-deal, and this second set of bankers didn't know about this relationship, so they didn't realize they had to move so fast, that the parent company had a huge incentive to sell itself quickly and quietly. Mm-hmm. So by changing bankers and not having informed bankers about this deal, they moved too slowly, and Rupert had read all the documents and knew he had to move fast. So he did the deal in 3 days.
Well, and it was this completely on the level. It was sort of my understanding here that Sumner Redstone was not sure whether in fact it was, or hasn't Viacom challenged this in court?
No, they have not, actually. They haven't. But there is a class action suit that's been winding its way through, but I'm not aware of its prospects for success. But in general, no, I talked to a lot of lawyers about it, and I'm not a lawyer, so I can't say it definitively. But, you know, once you have this kind of arrangement that allows, it was basically a double put option, they both could put to each other, it was fine for one of them to sell, and they, without telling the other. Especially a parent company selling to a subsidiary does not usually have an obligation to notify the subsidiary.
So it was just clearly a case maybe where Murdoch was just sharper on the details, or maybe he was better advised, or both, and that he jumped when he needed to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's just a matter of attention to detail. And like I said, I don't know if it was him or his advisors, but clearly they just had done their homework.
So did DeWolf and Anderson, the guys who started it, did they know about the talks between their parent, Intermix, and Murdoch?
They did know a little bit, but they didn't know sort of the extent to which these talks were at. So So I think the parent company kept them informed a little bit, like, hey, you know, we're just meeting with these guys. Nothing's really final. They were only informed about the fact that a deal was happening on the Friday before the Monday the deal was announced. So they did have a little bit of time to get their act together at the end there. But by that point, the deal was so far along that, you know, they must have made the decision not to do anything because they didn't try to round up Viacom for a last-minute bid, which they could have done.
Yeah. Well, did DeWolf and Anderson make substantial money out of this deal?
They did not. So that's the thing I think that's probably been most galling to them is that, you know, all the founders, it was them actually and a few others, all shared only about $20 million, which, of course, for regular people is a lot of money. But by the internet standards where the YouTube founders, you know, are sold their company for $1.8 billion and owned significant stakes, you know, this was not big-time internet money.
Yeah. So here's some more levels on which stealing maybe, depending on who you ask, works.
Right.
Well, first of all, that Murdoch bought the company, and I think a lot of people would say he bought it for less than it was worth. So maybe that was a steal. Maybe he stole it away from Sumner Redstone. But I wonder if DeWolf and Anderson somehow might not feel that it was stolen from them.
Yeah. I mean, I would think they probably did feel that way in some sense. And certainly after the deal, they did behave as if they were pretty annoyed for a little while. They really didn't want to cooperate with other News Corp divisions. They didn't want to move into the corporate offices. Eventually, they came around. But, you know, there was a sense there right after the deal of, wow, you know, this was stolen from us.
Yeah. Well, you talked a little bit earlier about the fact that it's just recently been announced that Chris DeWolf, would be stepping down from his job as CEO and would leave and was expected to leave the company, and that Tom Anderson, he would stay within the company, but he would be doing something different. He would move into a different job. Was that a case of guys being pushed out because News Corp essentially didn't want to have them around anymore?
Yeah, I think they were pushed, and I think that the reason is that MySpace is really stagnated. Like we, you know, talked about in the beginning, Facebook is overtaking them, has already overtaken them worldwide, is overtaking them in the U.S. for sure. And, you know, MySpace has lost ground. And the reason, there may be a lot of reasons for this. One is that there's just a faddish cycle to these things, that Facebook and Twitter are hot right now. But there's also the fact that MySpace looks dramatically the same as it did 4 years ago. A lot of the site's features and tools have not changed significantly. And on the internet, if you're not innovating, you're falling behind because it's always a features race. People want cooler, newer, flashier stuff.
Well, that, I suppose, gets to the question of how News Corp and whoever from News Corp was really running or overseeing the day-to-day operations at MySpace, what they were doing or not doing. And I suppose that some people might say, or at least might raise the question, well, does that mean that they bought something that they really don't understand, or at least they didn't understand the need for it to continue to be on the edge, to continue to innovate and do something new, that when you're in that business, you just can't just keep doing the same thing that you're doing?
Well, I think there were people at News Corp who were really trying to push MySpace to innovate more and to move faster, but they were unsuccessful. And I think what happened is over time, those people's arguments became more popular internally because all of a sudden it was clear that MySpace was losing ground. It was a harder argument to make when MySpace was big. It was the biggest. It was growing fast. Then the people who were arguing for innovation were saying, oh, well, you know what? Let these guys run it. They're doing fine. But now that the tide has turned, you know, that argument is going to have more resonance.
Well, another thing that I think is kind of interesting is this the relationship between or maybe relative importance of size, number of users, popularity, and whether or not you make money. Because while Twitter's growing and it's getting huge, and Facebook now is bigger than MySpace worldwide, and again, you correct me if I'm wrong, Facebook and Twitter aren't making money. MySpace
right.
actually is, not a lot, but
right.
it is, and maybe there's some reason why it is, and maybe things will change. But at least at this point, MySpace is making a profit. Facebook and Twitter aren't.
Right. That's correct. And MySpace has one really big thing going for it, which is a deal with Google. for guaranteed revenue of $900 million over 3.5 years. So it's still living on that right now. Mm-hmm. Its margins are pretty thin. So when that deal expires next year, it's not clear if MySpace will remain profitable unless they do some pretty big cost cutting right now.
Well, do the people at Facebook and Twitter, do they say, well, on the one hand, yeah, we're not making money, but on the other hand, look at how big we are, look at how many users, look at how people are talking about us all the time. The people over there at Twitter, they can talk about how we actually have new words now in the language,
right,
because of us, you know, tweets and Twittering and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
In terms of popular culture, these things are really very big. So that makes me wonder, well, you know, that's great, but there's, you know, how long are you going to be satisfied with being really hot and being really talked about and yet not making money? There's got to be some
right.
sort of a line where you have to say, look, and at some point we've got to start turning a profit.
Well, think about Google. You know, they actually spent years just perfecting their search algorithm and never running any ads, and everybody wrote them off. So what is going on with these guys? They're just doing this for nothing? And then when they turned on the ad system, I mean, boy, did they start minting money. So there's certainly an argument to be made for getting your product totally right before you monetize, and that maybe there's some concern about monetizing too much too soon. On the other hand, these are tough economic times, so, you know, making money is good. So I think that all these startups have to balance the two, right? Because users get pissed off if they're feeling like the ads are too aggressive and too crazy. I think MySpace actually done a pretty decent job of monetizing without driving people batty. But even they have, you know, like I said, the prospect of not being profitable next year.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing about these sites is you would think they would be kind of cheap to run because you're not creating the content. You don't have to hire reporters or anything. It just all you do is kind of host it. And so in theory, they should be such a great opportunity. You just sell the ad. Someone else writes the copy. But it's actually really expensive to run them.
How many employees does MySpace have?
I think they have about 1,600 right now.
Huh. That does raise in my question. Well, in my head, that question, what do all those people do?
Well, so first of all, it's hard to run these sites because they're massive parallel computing mm-hmm. issues. Mm-hmm. So you have to, when you load somebody's profile, you're pulling all the information from all these different databases about them and sort of constructing the page on the fly. So that's actually a pretty difficult thing to do. It's much easier to build a page that sort of looks the same each time you come to it, that's static or just has a few new elements each time. But every page that is built is basically personalized at that moment. So that's hard, right, because you have to put what the friends are doing. And so building those sites and keeping them running is no easy task. It requires, I think there was a moment in MySpace's history where they went through 8 tons of cardboard just unpacking servers in 1 year, just literally buying servers fast enough to keep up with their growth.
Okay. And does Facebook have as many people, or maybe because it's bigger, does it actually have more people?
I think Facebook is actually a little smaller, but I don't have the number in front of me, but they, I think they are. And that's partly because MySpace did a very aggressive international expansion where they put a lot of people around the world over to sell ads. I don't think Facebook has invested as heavily internationally, although they've actually done better internationally. And also MySpace has a very costly joint venture that they started with called MySpace Music. So in the last earnings call, I think News Corp said both of those things kind of were heavy cost expenses for MySpace.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Julia Angwin. She's an award-winning journalist at the Wall Street Journal. She writes there about the convergence of technology and media. She's the author of the recently published book, Stealing MySpace, The Battle to Control the Most Popular Website in America. It's published by Random House. And questions, again, are welcome, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You talked a little bit about Twitter. This is something different, relatively new, but it fits in this same universe of social networking services. I suppose that one of the things about Twitter is Twitter is a text-based service. It works with short messages. I think maybe one of the advantages to Twitter is that it's easy to use. You can use your cell phone to do it. you could use a PDA to do it. You wouldn't have to. You can use your computer, but you can use a smaller handheld device to do it. And the other thing, as you mentioned, it's really more about enough talk about you. Let's talk about me. It's for people sending out stuff about themselves. Does the success of this thing? Are there particular things about it that you, because you follow this area, that you find particularly interesting?
I do. I think Twitter has really got a couple great things going for it. One is mobile. Right, the world is going more and more mobile. I mean, I walk around the streets of New York, and I swear to God, half the people are holding a phone in front of their eyes as they walk. So, you know, it's getting harder to not bump into people on the streets, but it does show that everyone is just glued to their mobile devices. So Twitter being built for the mobile platform is a smart move. It's much harder to get these Facebook and MySpace because they have a lot more graphics and the pages are hard to load on your mobile device. The other thing Twitter has going for it is search. Search is the way we find everything online. Most of us always start with search when we're looking for information, and Twitter is really searchable. MySpace and Facebook are not. There are conversations going on all the time on MySpace and Facebook, but you can't easily search for a conversation. You can search for a person, but like when there's a news event, what happens is everyone goes to Twitter and searches on the news event. Yesterday it was swine flu all day long. Everyone was talking about swine flu. Now, they were talking about it on Facebook and MySpace. You couldn't easily search for it, though, and join a conversation. So in that sense, Twitter is also set up for our minds that we already think in search. And then it has this one-way relationship, which I talked about earlier, which is you don't have to agree to friend someone. You just follow them, which sort of lessens the burden on both of you.
Well, we have a caller here. Let's talk with him. Someone in Northern Illinois on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. Thank you for letting me talk to you. One question I do have, because I'm on the Internet as well, like everybody else is, but the problem that I have my little blob that I put out about myself. Somebody has stolen my bio and call him me.
Oh, okay, somebody's impersonating. That's the
problem with something like MySpace, that you could use that to do that.
And Twitter. Both of them not allow. Twitter says it doesn't allow impersonation, but there are so many people on there impersonating.
Is there anything that I could do? Because he's only 10 miles from me, and he has my bio word for word.
Is it on a social networking site?
Well, it's on the Internet.
Yeah, in general, you have to contact whoever has it and convince them to take it down. And I'm not sure. It sounds like I'm not sure who's hosting that website, but that's who you would want to get a hold of.
Well, that's one of the things that I'm sitting there doing. What's this guy? He's taken my page and called himself, and he's 10 miles from me, and he's saying the same thing, and he's saying that he has the same accolades and he has the same bio that I have.
Well, no, this is one of the big problems of the Internet is impersonation. Happens all the time. I was talking about this before with cyberbullying. It's one of the hardest things to do right now because we don't have a way to authenticate identities online. I do think we're going to need some sort of driver's license equivalent for online because these problems are just becoming more and more common.
Yeah. Well, as it stands now, the only thing I could do is just smile and grin and walk away.
Well, it sounds like the other thing that the caller could do, as you said, Julia, was to go find out who the ISP, I guess, would be for the person who is hosting that person's. If you have your own website and somebody else decides to start their website and say that they're you, then there's really not much you can do other than go to the person that is hosting that website and say, look, this person, they're not me. I'm me. Other than that, there's really nothing an individual could do.
Yeah, I mean, it is harder. In a way, it's actually easier on the social networking sites like Twitter and MySpace and Facebook because they are used to getting these kind of complaints. So most of them have set up a thing where you can sort of submit a form saying so-and-so is pretending to be me and here's why I'm me. But if it's just a random website, that is harder. You have to figure out who owns it and talk to them. And if they won't listen, you have to go to the ISP.
Yeah. I'm afraid that's probably about the best answer we can give to the caller. You've said, though, interestingly enough, you said you think that it is a problem that somehow needs to be addressed. Is there, in fact, some way to address that?
It's complicated and difficult because we have ways of authenticating identity in the real world, but they usually involve showing a physical thing. I mean, either you usually show a driver's license somewhere, or you can use your credit card when you're purchasing things. But we don't have a system of, these places like MySpace and Facebook are places you congregate to talk. So we're not used to the idea of having to show ID to go to a bar and chat or to show ID to hang out in a courtyard and chat in public spaces. So it's not, people wonder what is the right level of identity that you need to do for that, because there is a right to organize and to have free speech. And so when you're getting together to chat about politics or something, do we really want to ID everyone? So these are complex questions that people are thinking about a lot, but it's hard to know what the right way to do it is. And the other problem is children, right? Kids don't have driver's licenses or credit cards often, and they are online a lot. So what do we do about them?
We're coming down to the point where we have just a couple of minutes left. One of the ways that you can read this story, I guess, is you can read it as an evolution of a technology or of an application, really. And you can see how if somebody starts out with an idea and somebody comes along and says, well, that looks pretty good, I can do that, and maybe I can give it my own little spin, or I can introduce features that it didn't have before. And then the next person comes along and says, well, I can go that one better. And things over time change interesting ways. New sort of functions get added in the case of MySpace, some intentionally, some by accident. That, and I'm sure that for somebody who watches these things like you, what people want to know is, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
Where are things going? What do you think that the next iteration of this kind of thing might be? Do you have a feeling about that?
I have some thoughts about it. One thing, a couple of things I'm passionate about. One is this thing that I hate, which I call the unitary identity, which is that when you look for someone online, you Google their name, and whatever shows up is sort of what defines them. But so for me, it's just me as an author. All my pages refer to me as an author. But I'm more than that. You know, I have hobbies, I have children, I have a family life. So I would like to be able to represent those in multiple areas, but not all of them be public. So I do think we're going to have more multiple identities online, and I think we need to have some of those identities be in what I would call safe spaces, places that are not searchable and that people are really authenticated to be who they are. And it's not clear to me if that's going to happen in Facebook or maybe on another site where you set up your own little personal social network like Ning, but I think we're going to want to represent more of our identities online, just like we do offline. And so I think we're going to be managing more of these sites, but I think it's going to help us stay in touch with each other better.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I find myself, though, I'm wondering, I'm sure there are people who would say something like, why would you want to have your identity online like that? They would say, maybe they have concerns about privacy, or they're just not interested. They're not interested in putting themselves out there that way.
I agree that it's not a perfect experience, but at the same time, this is how we live. If you're not searchable online, to some people, you don't exist. To some employers, they wonder who you are. You know, it's becoming our calling card. And so my feeling is it's better to actively manage it than to just leave it to chance, because if you don't manage your online identity, it will be managed for you. Someone else will create a page that mentions you. So I tell everyone that it's better to set up your own profile online so that the first thing that comes up when people search is your LinkedIn page, which is what you want the world to know about you, rather than let it just pull up some random sports game that you won and had your name in it, which is fine also. But you have to manage how you present yourself to the world, just like you choose what clothes to wear in the morning.
Or I suppose, yeah, we don't want to get into a situation like the caller who said that someone has stolen their identity, in a sense, online, and they're representing themselves as him when, in fact, they're not.
Yes, which is why, you know, another thing he can do is make sure he's built like 10 pages for himself with his name that are really him and push that guy lower down in the Google search.
Well, just we're almost at the point where we have to finish, and I mentioned a little bit a couple of times of your background that I think is really interesting. I guess I'm just curious about you having started out with this idea that you would somehow be involved in technology, and that you went to University of Chicago and you majored in math and worked summers at Hewlett-Packard. So what was it about being a writer, being a journalist that really grabbed you?
Honestly, my parents were both in startups all my life, and they were constantly working for a startup, and then it would go under, and they'd work for another one. And it was fun, but I so much more appreciate it from the other side, writing about it. Maybe I'm risk-averse, but I really love the stories involved. But the life of technology, it's a hard life. These companies come and go, and I just didn't – for some reason, it didn't appeal to me.
Well, I'm sure that in doing what you do, that I suppose there's some kind of a risk. You know, they could decide tomorrow they didn't want to have you at the Journal anymore.
Oh, yeah. I mean, God, there's so much risk involved with being a newspaper reporter. In fact, it's basically over newspapers. But, I mean, I think that writing is not over in journalism. And so that – and I just love the stories about – technology. It's one of the few industries that's still really innovating and growing in this country, and so many of the other industries are contracting and shrinking. So it's a really fun story.
Yeah. Well, there's another great story there. We could have had another conversation about, is there any future for the newspaper business?
I know. That is another topic.
I guess one of the things, though, that's really interesting about the Journal is that right from the beginning, they were asking people to pay for the content when other people were giving it away. And the problem that other news organizations, I think, have is that people got used to getting it for free.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the best things we've done, I think, at the Journal is charging for content. And I hope that it'll turn around and everyone will, because otherwise we aren't going to have reporters. And journalism is really important for our democracy.
Our guest this morning, Julia Angwin, she works for the Wall Street Journal. Her book is Stealing My Space, published by Random House. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.